Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Matt Kinnear, joined by Terry Foy and Kevin Brown. The source is back. January is here. Scrimmages are going on. And we have a top 20 in the land. The preseason Inside Lacrosse media poll has been unveiled with Virginia as the number one team in the country. Not the defending champion Maryland Terrapins. The Virginia Cavaliers are number one. And Terry, I'm going to start with you since you do your weekly top 20 throughout the season, every Monday afternoon and Tuesday morning, kind of talking about, you know, the ups and downs and who you think are the best teams and who's rising and who's falling. So you're a little bit of an expert here in this this top 20 realm. When you look at this top 20 that the media has produced, and, you know, this is 26 different media members who vote in the IL media poll, what sticks out to you? What surprises you most?
Well, I mean, first of all, you should probably have asked that question to somebody who voted Virginia number one, because I voted Maryland number one. So I guess to an extent, I'm surprised that the Cavaliers are number one. And I think that stems from a number of things, one of which is a reflection of the most substantial question I have heading into this spring, which is how to weigh and value what we saw in the fall. I think that when I, you know, go back 12 months, one of the things that positioned me better than many media members to, for lack of a better way of putting it, respect the Ivy League was putting heavy emphasis on what we saw in the fall. You know, from teams like Cornell, who played Maryland tough, and Penn, who dominated Navy, and Yale, who took it to Syracuse and Ohio State. But when I think about that in the context of this year, I kind of have the opposite reaction, because it felt like a disproportionate number of players didn't play in the fall. And Virginia falls into that category for me. I got an opportunity to see them play at the American Boy Foundation event in Northern Virginia. And there was no Peyton Cormier. There was Connor Schellenberger had been with the U.S. national team the 2 days prior. So he was very tired, and Griffin Schutz took on that role as kind of like the lead initiator. From a defensive standpoint, I believe there was no Cade Sostad. There was definitely no Cole Kastner. There was definitely no Quentin Matsui. There was no and his Grayson Saladay. So, and, you know, there was no kind of star transfers from Vermont and Stanford. But at the same time, you know, I left that feeling a little cold about Virginia. And I know that I'm not the only one, because Lars Tiffany said to me after the event, he's like, have you ever seen a Virginia team that struggled this much athletically and didn't win their matchups? Like, he was kind of flummoxed by it. And when I asked him what was next, he's like, the weight room and the speed department. So, again, if I'm having the same reaction that I did a year ago, I'm really emphasizing the fact that Virginia didn't have a great showing and saying, not the number one team in the country. Whereas, you know, Maryland put in a good effort against Cornell. They put in a pretty good effort against the U.S. national team. You know, word on the street is that they beat Duke in their early season spring scrimmage. You know, but on the other hand, I think across the board, I'm kind of discrediting some of the fall results. So, you know, I use the word flummoxed in terms of Lars Tiffany's reaction to seeing his team play, and I feel like that's kind of the way that I, and by virtue of having four teams receiving number one votes, I think that's kind of the way the media feels about this spring season as well.
Well, flummoxed, Terry, but at some point, I mean, the knowns are known, right? All of those people that you mentioned for Virginia, we did not need to see them in fall ball in order to know what they can produce. A year ago with the Ivy League, we did not know what those guys were capable of, given the year off and all the circumstances, and, you know, even some of the, you know, composition of the rosters a year ago when we were thinking about this was kind of in question and not really known at that point. So, you know, to me, I think Virginia is such a known commodity. And Kevin, you're probably one of the rare people who has seen both of these teams in person kind of over this offseason span. You went to a Virginia practice, so you weren't at a scrimmage event, but you also were at the Maryland Cornell fall ball event, the scrimmage that they played. So you have a little bit of a, you know, when you're comparing the two teams side by side, does anything stick out to you about maybe why you would go one way or the other? And who did you vote for as number one?
Yeah, so I voted for Virginia. as the number one team in the preseason poll, purely because I have questions of how well this new look Maryland offense will hold up in the spring. They look great, so I saw them not only against Cornell up in Springfield, but also during the Fall Classic against Team USA, which slower pace, international rules definitely suited them to be a little more deliberate and allowed them to not get mismatched athletically as much as one would have expected against some of the best players in the world on the red, white, and blue. But the Cornell game opened my eyes to a lot of things with new roles of players like Owen Murphy, who will play at X, it seems like. He's got the change of direction that you want from a quarterback of the offense, and he can find guys from some incredible skip passes. I know he had the chemistry with Danny Maltz going. Almost called him Dylan, like I often do. But like Terry, I saw Virginia practice in Charlottesville, and there was 18 guys missing. Thomas McConvey was injured. Connor Schellenberger was really running things. It was Cole Kastner's first practice, or one of his first week back at practice that week. He was really running things defensively. And they were still just super impressive athletically, and you know they had the fire under their bellies, so to speak, after what was a lackluster weekend against Lehigh and who else was really scrimmaging?
Penn State. And when you said Springfield earlier, I'm pretty sure that it was also at Springfield High School in Northern Virginia. I think both of the events, if memory serves, were at Springfield High Schools.
All right, look at that.
And Virginia this weekend will be at Springfield High School against Navy in one of the kind of premier scrimmages of the preseason here.
Yep, so Navy, I think, is also another team to watch for. I'm sure we'll maybe get to some teams that are considered down the list. But yeah, it was really splitting hairs between Virginia and Maryland, and that defense is so legit for the Terps. Logan McNaney anchoring that squad is going to be legit. But just you add in a 6'5", 250 linebacker in Ricky Miaison, and we'll see how much of an impact he has with that midfield. But guys like Griffin Schutzler are going to take a big leap this year, and we all know the knowns for Virginia are coming back. So I lean towards them, but it was definitely a tough decision.
Yeah, I don't know if you can use Ricky Miaison as like a trump card when we just learned that Dante Trader is playing for Maryland. So I feel like at the very best or very worst, potentially, that cancels out. I know Miaison probably has about 30 pounds on Trader, but Trader also has at least one, if not 2 years more recently, of having played lacrosse on Miaison.
But you have certain intel that Trader is maybe playing on some D-mid instead of O-mid.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the conversation that we want to have, but if you want to talk about who's playing offense and defense, I'm all about it.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Terry. You kind of like got people stirred up with your comments about how Miaison will be used. So, I mean, we're talking about the number one and two teams in the country. We're talking about the poll. So let's just dive in. How do you think he can be used? And, you know, will he be an effective piece, you know, given the uncertainty of a guy who's been playing football for so long and now just getting back into lacrosse, you know?
This is such a layered conversation. You know, first of all, I think you kind of have to address the elephant in the room, which is the fact that whenever you talk about a black midfielder, there is a predisposition to say he's going to play defense. So, you know, I think that, you know, TJ Kemp has done a nice job of tackling that issue head on. And, you know, it's a decades long problem. You know, I've talked to coaches who were watching Kyle Harrison at 205 and saying, man, he's going to be the best emitter on our team. And, you know, some of the guys that I talked to were just like, what? What are you talking? Like, what? So, you know, that's why I kind of get, you know, my dander up a little bit about the topic in the first place. But the other side of the coin is that you have to consider which skill is actually harder from the standpoint of learning and getting reacquainted. And I think that there's a I don't want to say consensus.
Lars has there's a big opinion on this.
So, yeah, okay, then I'll give you the floor in a second. I mean, my opinion is that it's easier to run straight and shoot than it is to know when you have to support and know where you have to be on a clear and know what your responsibilities are in the sub game. So, like, I'm not trying to discredit my own point about the fact that, you know, I mean, this just, it kind of harkens back, and it's kind of funny now, right, with, like, half the NFL starting quarterbacks being black. But, you know, Matt, you and I are old enough to remember when Donovan McNabb was like, oh, is he smart enough to play quarterback, was like a topic of radio conversation. And obviously that has been laid to rest a long time ago. But it's like, from the standpoint of playing lacrosse, the issue of reacclimation doesn't have much to do with the, I guess I should say that, In the opinion of high-end college, or, you know, top 20 college coaches, the comfort with your stick, your stick skills, are less of an issue relative to understanding what to do. And it is easier for an offensive player to know what to do than it is for a defensive player to know what to do, because a defensive player's responsibilities are dependent on the decisions of five other people and requires a lot of cohesion. Whereas you can design an offense where an individual offensive player's decisions are very direct and simplified.
Especially in a team defensive setting, which Coach Lars Tiffany and I were... He was just chewing my ear off for 10 minutes about how the transition into college lacrosse is super difficult for defensive players. And he's really harped on the improvement upon team defensive rotations and settings with guys like Evans in the off season. And he was hesitant to start Cole Kastner back in the day when he was a freshman, but luckily he had coaches tell him that that was a smart thing to do. He had the physical attributes, but it's definitely a interesting conversation. But
I think he's going to be electric, and, you know, Virginia, like, needs help at offensive midfield. You know, I think that's a place where they could use a little bit more depth, and I think he's going to do that. And I also voted for Virginia as the number one team in the country. I voted.
Boo. Where's your Maryland bias? I'm the lone not Terp on here who voted for Maryland number one. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and I mean the Midwesterner voting for Maryland, whereas all the Marylanders on our staff have all voted for Virginia. Or yep. Other teams. I am surprised by...
Georgia. I am known as a Virginia hater, though, so I suppose in that respect it's not surprising. Virginia was my number two team, for what it's worth.
Well, you did pick against them, what, every game when they won the championship?
No, I was accused of that, but in fact, I actually picked against them against both Brown and in... I didn't pick them against Maryland in the quarterfinals, but I did pick them against Brown.
I am surprised by, you know, the Georgetown and Notre Dame votes. I thought this was pretty clearly a two-horse race in terms of who's the number one team in the country, Virginia and Maryland. Notre Dame getting three votes is a little bit puzzling to me. I think that's a little bit of poking the bear a little bit about the fact that they didn't get in the NCAA tournament last year.
A political granted, statement, if you will.
Yeah, a little bit of a statement there. But, you know, Notre Dame is, you know, I had them somewhere, you know, pretty high up, I think, in my top five. I'll pull up my votes. I had them at number five in the country, so... You know, no harm there. The thing that's interesting to me... What?
Well, I just want to point out that when Notre Dame didn't have Jake Taylor in 2022, they were 2-4. And when they did, they were 6-0. So, do they have Jake Taylor for the first 6 or 8 games of the season this year? No, they don't. So, I mean, I understand that Chris Kavanaugh's improvement, Will Lynch's improvement, Brian Tevlin's arrival, Chris Fake's arrival, Chris Conlon's arrival, Liam Entman's improvement, all these factors might overcome that. But for me, it's a geometry problem. And it came down to the reliability of that third attackman. So everything I just said doesn't affect the role of the third attackman. And clearly, that was what was the determining factor between how good they were versus how bad they could be in 2022. And it's not to say that whether it's a Riccardelli or a Westland that solves the problem this year, that it can't be solved. It could be solved, but both those options were available last year and it didn't solve the problem. So then you're not just betting on the improvement of those guys, you're also betting on the improvement, and by those guys I'm referring to Will Lynch and Chris Kavanaugh and Liam Mentiman and everybody else, you're also betting on the improvement of whoever that ends up winning that third attackman spot, which in and of itself might be the problem. The problem might be that they don't know which of those two guys or any other contender for the spot is actually the best bet.
Well, Terry, you say they were 2-4 without some proper context here, in the sense that, let's see, three of those losses that we're talking about were against the teams that are right in front of them in this year's poll. So it's not like they lost, you know, those games. And the other was to Ohio State team that I think kind of took everyone a little bit by surprise last year in terms of how good they
were. So just, if you can, who are they playing in their first 6 or 8 games this year?
They're the same exact teams.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, does that, and what were they, I mean, what were they ranked after week, you know, 5 or whatever? I remember getting some hate mail last year about how
we were favoring them because at 2-4 they were still like the 14th ranked team in the country or something along those lines.
Yeah, they were still like,
and ultimately they ended up vindicating it from the standpoint of going 6-0 down the stretch. And again, I'm not saying the same thing might not happen again. I was talking to Kevin Corrigan in the summer, and he talked about how the timing of Jake's injury might actually be even more beneficial than it was last year, because this summer, in the summer of 22, he was injured playing box in Colorado, which meant that he had his surgery, and then he immediately came back to South Bend. So he was on campus while he was rehabbing all fall, whereas the year prior, he had his injury during the season, which meant that he was essentially rehabbing for the first like 2 months at home. And, you know, Casey was kind of optimistic that his rehabbing on campus was going to ensure that, you know, that speed of improvement or rate of improvement was faster. And so, you know, again, I mean, is he going to come out and score 8 goals in his first game in the Carrier Dome? Like, I don't know. But again, I look at it, for me, Notre Dame is very solidly a 7-8-9 team. You know, and it's not to, I'm not quibbling about the difference between 5 and 7. Like, that's not the point I'm trying to make. But the difference between voting them number one versus where I think they belong until they prove and show their solution for not having Jake Taylor is definitely worth a handful of spots away from that top of the chart.
I think for sure voting them number one is questionable. Voting them number five is giving them a little bit of benefit of the doubt. The thing that really interests me with this poll is, And just, you know, with the conferences in general this year, is just how many of these races between conference opponents that I feel like they're just clustered right next to each other and I don't know who to side among. You know, you look at, you know, I think it's pretty clear that, like, Maryland's the best team in the Big Ten. Georgetown's the best team in the Big East. But then you look at, you know, is it Cornell or Princeton? And then you go down, is it Yale or Penn? I think you can kind of put any of those four teams, but really those clusters of two right next to each other. Is it Notre Dame or Duke at that next thing? Is it Rutgers or Ohio State when you're talking about the Big Ten? These decisions are, you know, all of these teams that I've talked about are all teams that make up our top 11 or so in the media poll. And I really could argue for any combination of either of them going against each other. And Ohio State Rutgers is one that Terry and I have talked about quite a bit, you know, on our group Slack. But I want to talk about Duke. You know, when we're talking with this ACC, Duke, Brendan O'Neill has, when we did our top 50 players, Brendan O'Neill was the one person who got the most feedback about his positioning in that. I'm sure there's going to be feedback when we do the All-Americans about where he is ranked in that. And, you know, he's the guy who's picked for Team USA. He's potentially the most talented player in the country, you know, depending on who you talk to. I was just having a conversation in the office of a coach just talking about Brendan O'Neill and how good he is and what he can do. So Duke, though, just underperforming last year, we have them at number 8 in the country. We got a little bit of feedback from their scrimmages and heard that they played well against Maryland, but why can Duke be a much better team this year than last year? And maybe not much better, but close out those games and just have a better record and be a tournament team and I guess, perform to what people expect of them?
Well, it comes down to two things. One, you hit on, it's unleashing the only player in college lacrosse to make Team USA for next summer's championships, and giving him the full keys to the offense, which he's kind of been incrementally getting more of as his college career has gone on. But making sure he's the focal point and having that kind of pecking order down. But also, the second thing is far more important and something us as a staff discussed a lot during the 22 season is just effort. It's the effort plays weren't there in 22. So getting between the lines and making sure, like, February lacrosse matters for once down in Durham, well, it's going to be important. Now that the Ivy League is so good, you have to ensure that each game counts. And Duke, you can't be losing to Syracuse. You can't be taking any games off.
And, Terry, how does Andrew McAdory play into this?
Yeah, so first I want to answer your original question, which is how can they be better? And I think the answer is that they won't be better. But that doesn't mean that they won't approach and execute better in games, which is to say that I have a hard time envisioning them being more talented than they were without Nekhai Montgomery and Sean Lully and Joe Robertson. And certainly when you consider their goalie situation, Mike Adler having been a solid starter for a couple of years, not even, you know, it's unclear at this point whether Andrew Bonifide or Will Helm, the St. Lawrence transfer, is going to take over. I do think that there is one ace card, and that's Jake Naso. He was at 56% last year. I mean, I don't think that it's impossible for a Luke Wierman-esque improvement to kind of come to fruition. But, you know, the other way to consider this is, so a 2-goal loss to Jacksonville, a 1-goal loss to Penn, a 2-goal loss to Loyola when they were dominating in the first half, a 4-goal loss at Syracuse when, you know, getting from Durham to Syracuse is definitely a bugaboo for the program and has been. And then a pair of close losses to Notre Dame. You know, they were 11-6, and when you dive into those results, it's pretty easy to turn two of them, because on the other hand, like, you look at it and it's not as if there were a bunch of like 1 or 2 goal wins that could have theoretically gone the other way. When they won, they dominated. And so as a result, to Kevin's point, you know, is it effort? That's just, I shy away from that term because it's like a little too critical. It's not so much about effort, in my opinion, as it is about focus and making sure that you're not susceptible to just getting gotten. And I think that's where the biggest thing this team can have over last year that can overcome a huge talent deficit. And that's not saying they're going to have a huge talent deficit, but they could have a huge talent deficit and still overcome it if the role definition and delineation and the guy's ability to, like, fill their role and embrace their role is better and more easily understood. And so, you know, unfortunately, I'm not sure that it's actually that evident right now. Because to your point about Andrew McAdory, I mean, first of all, the issue, in my opinion, is that they haven't had a quarterback, right? They didn't have a quarterback last year. And with Michael Sowers, they had a quarterback who wasn't used to essentially playing with guys who were as prolific as the guys that he played with in the 2021 season. And so as a result, there was always a little bit of tension there. Andrew McAdory has to be the quarterback of this team, because there is nobody else on the roster that has the skill set to do it. And that's no disrespect to Tommy Schelling, but I just know that it's not going to be him. So as a result, it has to be McAdory. And he's got to figure out a way to facilitate with two lefties that, generally speaking, are going to occupy the same space in Dyson Williams and Brennan O'Neill. Those guys are going to be on the field together a lot. And so by virtue of that, there is going to be a math and geometry problem. It's not unsolvable. it's just not normal. So the options, the answers, the solutions aren't like readily available. And so then when you consider like, how are these midfielders going to support? Are they going to be knockdown stretch shooters? Are they going to be Dodgers who bang it through X? Like, those are questions that we're going to have to see as well. There's a lot of two-way talent on this team, so theoretically they should be good in transition. You know, but ultimately you've got the best end of shot clock guy that exists in lacrosse in Brendan O'Neill. And it's just a function of how does that role manifest with everybody else. The goalie question is an enormous one. I mean, we've seen enough good, talented defenses, you know, really crumble efficiency-wise because they were giving up shots that were supposed to be saved and they weren't saved. Again, doesn't mean that there isn't going to be a quality answer in this roster, but that's a big question that lurks. So for me, like, I mean, candidly, I think they're pretty clearly a tick behind Notre Dame as the best team, as the third best team in the ACC.
Guys, when we're looking at the back half of this poll, or just the whole poll in general, who was your outlier? Who was the team that you most deviated from what the consensus became in the media poll? Kevin, we'll start with you.
Great question. So I had Denver at 20, so I at least ranked them. I know Terry will get to you, but in the show notes, you said you didn't really consider them. Let's see. Richmond, I thought, I'm higher on Richmond than it seems like the media is. I had them up at 16. So it's really small, like four or five spots between those two. And the rest were pretty in line. I mean, I had, it was great podcasting, but I had Penn at 7, which, so I was surprised they fell all the way down to 10. I don't think that's justifiable. You mentioned the lumping together in the conferences, and I think no better example is the Ivy League, because you can go a number of ways with Penn, Princeton, Yale, and Cornell, I think, has been the clear, obvious choice to start atop the conference, making it to that title game last season. And then you get to the Harvard and Browns of the conference, but nothing too significant. And I would say Penn is my kind of big shtick I would push back against the media of voting them a little lower than I expected.
That's my answer as well. You know, I had Yale and Penn as kind of like an interchangeable 6-7, and I feel right now like I would go with Penn at 6 and Yale with 7, and I'm definitely influenced by spending yesterday, or we're recording this on Monday night, it'll post on Tuesday morning. So 2 days ago, 48 hours ago, we were recording a video interview with Sam Hanley, and, you know, I can't really put my finger on exactly why I came away from that with a higher opinion or kind of a more bullish perspective on the team than I did going in. And it's not like meaningfully more bullish. It's just, you know, incrementally so, but I don't know, man. I think, you know, it's probably fair to say that the Quakers lost more than the Bulldogs, despite the fact that, you know, two of Notre Dame's starters are going to be former Yale Bulldogs, and they're not the only guys that they lost from that team. But at the same time, you know, one of the most interesting things that Sam said was, we learned from the Rutgers game that we need to play more guys. And I think it's going to be a challenge for this team, because ultimately, one of the hallmarks of this program is that Mike Murphy schedules 12 games against 12 good teams. And as you saw last year, when they won three consecutive games in the last 2 seconds by one goal, there is no margin for error in the schedule that Penn puts together. And so as a result, there's very little opportunity for players 23 through 38 on the roster to get on the field and get their sea legs and understand the difference between game action versus practice action. And Sam mentioned that we're trying to do our best in practice to simulate game settings, but you can do your best. You can do the best job that anybody does in practice in all of college lacrosse, and it's still not going to be enough. So they've got to figure out a way to, you know, in the end of second quarters, beginning of third quarters, you know, get their third line middies runs, get their fourth and fifth attackmen on the field, get their fourth and fifth defenseman on the field. You know, this is going to sound weird, but pray for an injury, right? Like, you know, a couple of well-timed, 2-3 week muscle strain injuries actually end up having benefits in the way that they develop, further depth. But there is talent there. And particularly when you consider offensively what they looked like last year, I think that there's a lot of reasons to believe that you're going to have what you had in Hanley and Dylan Gurgar from a shooting standpoint. You know, maybe they shoot 18 times a game instead of 24 times a game combined collectively. But, some of that action gets opened up for, Ben Smith and Rob Shane and some of the other guys on the roster who definitely have shown themselves to be capable, emerged toward the end of the season. And I think there's reasons for high expectations for the Quakers. I had them at 6 or 7 and they came in at 10. So that's to speak to, how dramatically different it was from my expectations.
Yeah, I've been beating this drum all off season, but St. Joe's was my team that I had much higher. I had them up at 11. I'm sure I've voted them the highest as anyone in the country. But I think that they are just going to shock everyone this year. And if you look at their last season, obviously they had the loss to Yale in the NCAA tournament, which was one of the most exciting games that we saw in the tournament. That was a 2-goal loss. One goal loss to Penn. That was another late loss. And then Delaware and Drexel earlier in the season that, they hadn't quite found their groove yet at that point. And then, the Drexel one I know was just they got a really bad penalty and had some injuries and lost that game. I think St. Joe's, just everything about that program has just kind of ratcheted up. When you talk about shifting to the A-10, the facilities projects they have going on, all of the guys that they have come back, they have basically the entire team, a little bit in the midfield is gone. But man, there's just a lot of momentum that feels like this is the year that they gotta go big or go home. Although next year too, they got basically that attack back for I believe the entire attack is back for another year after this year too. So this
they're
is
just not gonna get force fed possessions by Zach Cole.
Yeah, and then exactly Zach Cole being the guy who most singularly has just raised the level of this program. He's second team All-American, and what he can do, not just from a points perspective, but just kind of manipulating the sub game in terms of the way that St. Joe's plays is really special. Not only just him winning the ball at an insane amount. So Zach Cole is just really awesome. So St. Joe's is the team that I had a lot higher. I had Denver at 20 instead of 17 where they ended up. But other than that, it was pretty much, within three of the average there. The receiving votes teams. So Syracuse is the team receiving the most votes outside of the top 20. I struggled with this because I think we know the potential of this freshman group. And, obviously it's Syracuse. There's a lot of talent. I just couldn't put them. It sounds... and I'm talking very 90s lacrosse here. It sounds odd to have Jacksonville and Richmond and Denver and St. Joe's and Boston U and all these teams over Syracuse, but these teams are just more proven and talented than Syracuse, with the exception of can that Syracuse freshman class really kind of propel them into this next level? And I think they just have more to prove than anyone else.
Let me make the argument for Syracuse. So they open with Vermont at home. We saw that game last year. Vermont is probably not going to be as good as they were last year. And then they have Albany at home and they have Holy Cross at home. They play Maryland on February 18th. That's a neutral site game down in Maryland. Then they have Carolina, Duke, Hopkins at home. Now, Carolina and Hopkins are right at Syracuse's level, right? Like they're both in that, 19 to 24 range. And then Duke, we've already talked about, they might be considerably better than them, but they also might be more in that realm. And we already talked about how difficult it is for the Blue Devils to make that trip to the Carrier Dome. So if they get him again, and then they have Hofstra, Bonaventure, Hobart, it is April 1st, and you can literally imagine a scenario in which Syracuse is 8-1. It's pretty shocking. But it's also not that outrageous.
Should you get credit for making your schedule easier to play and win more games?
Yes, absolutely you should. Sometimes you get extended. Actually, a lot of times you get extended. There are a lot of guys who've made NCAA tournament appearances in years 6, 7, 8, and 9 because they made their schedules really easy in year 4 or 5.
Right, but we're not talking RPI math. We're talking subjective, I think this team is better. You know, yeah, they might
Do you get credit from a preseason voting standpoint? I mean, if you're going to ask that question literally, we're going to go so far off the path in terms of what are we actually doing with this exercise? Like, right. Like, is your number one team – all right, if you could choose that your number one team spent the most weeks at number one over the course of the season or was 0 weeks the number one team but won the national championship, which would you choose?
I would think a more accurate representation of number one would be the team that was number one most through the season, not the champion.
Kevin, please tell me the champion. Please tell me you're voting for the champion and just like illustrate my point perfectly.
Kinnear is like the Premier League fan of the three of us.
I don't even know what the Premier League is. Like, you know.
But the
champion is the team that just like. They won the game, you know, like they won the championship game, you know, obviously like.
Well, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the best preseason number one pick. And I think, again, like ultimately the core of this issue is that we don't know what exercise we're trying to do, right? There's no consensus about what a preseason poll is supposed to accomplish. Is it supposed to most closely mirror the poll in week one? Or is it supposed to most closely mirror the poll in week 17?
Which is why we have 26 different people do it. To get varying
with 26 different methodologies, yes.
Right. To get some sort of, you know, mix it together, and this is what you get.
But if you voted Syracuse number 8 to start the season, and then they're 8-1, you're not going to take a victory lap? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, candidly, like, it was a huge part of my motivation, or not motivation, my thought process last year, right? If I knew that they were playing teams that they could beat out of the gate, I would have had a much different opinion on it. But when I was getting chirped for not having Syracuse in my preseason top 20 last year, I was like, all right, well, let's revisit this conversation on March 5th. And they were 3-4.
Well, also, you're considering, I'm considering that Albany's going to go in there and win inside in the Carrier Dome on February 10th.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not trying to.
So
I'm not selling tickets to a neutral site AFC championship game in Atlanta. Like that's not what I'm trying to accomplish with this one.
But outside, did you have Terry, did you have anyone that you voted for that fell outside the top 20?
Loyola, who I had, I think at 19. And I feel good about that. I think they ended up at 25 or the equivalent of 25. When you look at the receiving votes in order of votes received, and you know, I mean, they're going to be better than people expect. I mean, they're going to struggle winning faceoffs. Goalie play is a huge question mark. I think Luke Stout has the opportunity to be really good, assuming that he wins the starting position. Don't know whether he will or not. They've got tons of options defensively. They've got like 6 long poles who are like of that Loyola mold. And you know, you talked about the role that Owen Murphy can play for Maryland. I think that Luke Murphy is going to be a really important player for Loyola. So it's going to be a challenging spring for the Murphy family in terms of figuring out which... Well, I guess they're just going to fly from Boston to BWI regardless. So, you know, whether they're heading to College Park or you know, Cold Spring Lane is a question for the day.
Kevin, what about you? Anyone that you had outside?
I don't think so, actually.
Your 20 was the exact 20?
My 20 did match the 20, which was no collusion, no corruption in here, but there was, you know, you mentioned Loyola there, like, the Patriot League low-key, like, I'm becoming a big fan of watching all the Patriot League games. Army and Navy are going to be, like, a lot better than people expect this year as well. Navy's got a lot of young players that I saw ball out against Penn and St. John's this fall. And Army, we heard good things.
We should
mention
that BU apparently got destroyed by Rutgers in a preseason scrimmage a couple days ago.
Yeah,
we should mention
that. Not going to overreact to that one either.
Should not overreact to it, but it's maybe the sort of thing a certain head coach wants for his team that did quite well last season until that first round game.
To your point about the Patriot League, it is arguably, you know, when you look at the Big Ten, ACC, Ivy League as, you know, kind of your top three, But when you talk about interest, the Patriot League and A-10 are sneakily just, like, super interesting top to bottom. And
yeah, this got to be an A-10 podcast.
I had Navy as number 20, as number 19 in my poll. I flip-flopped between basically them and Army over and over again. And, you know, Navy was the last thing that I decided on. That's how close I think it is. So, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty in terms of, you know, I think Boston University deserves the nod because of how much they return. And, you know, they proved it last year. But I think we saw in the NCAA tournament, they're pretty feast or famine the way that they play. And the game against Rutgers, the Rutgers scrimmage, which, you know, sounds like Rutgers won that pretty handily, you know, doesn't give me
their
a lot
first
of
10 shots went in. So, yes, I think it's safe to say that that was pretty handily.
Pretty handily is an understatement there. You know, I do think that the Patriot League is a four-team race in terms of who's the best team in that conference. I think it's the most wide open at the top, so to speak. Yeah.
Not a three-team race for a second?
No, not at all.
No way. Definitely not.
Wait, you're talking to, are you saying no way to me or to Kevin?
I'm saying that to Kevin. Like, no disrespect to Boston University, who I saw practice in the fall. You know, Ryan Pulley has done a great job building a 10-year-old program, but, like, history dictates, I mean, what they did last year is the anomaly until they do it 3 or 4 years in a row, right? Like, you know, this is a league that Loyola has had the edge, generally speaking, right? And it's not the largest edge. It's not as dominant as you might, as Patriot League coaches might have worried in 2013 when they joined. But, you know, I'm not even...
And it might be
it's weird. That's kind of where I was going. Yeah, I'm not ready to rule Lehigh out and relegate them to that fifth spot. And honestly, I'm not even willing to rule Bucknell out. I think that ultimately what the way that it'll shake out is that those, I mean, I'm in a little bit of a wait and see mode with Navy. So even though I think Army is going to have a ton, well, not I think they do have a ton of holes to fill. For me, the tiers are BU, Loyola, and Army, relatively small gap, Navy, very very small gap, Lehigh, Bucknell. Gap, but not as big as it has been in some past years. Lafayette and Colgate, or probably Colgate and Lafayette, and then small gap and Holy Cross. That's kind of the way I see it shaking out.
Yeah, I mean it's, but again, to the point of like, it's not only like interesting depth wise, but to me it spans a little bit. I'm giving a little bit more credence to the fact that, you know, there's four or five teams who might be the best team, not just, you know, tiers of three and two or whatever. You know, so I went with Navy, but again, if you ask me 3 hours from now, I might go with Army. I think
so. Hold on, let me ask you a little bit more about Navy specifically, because Patrick Skalniak might be, you know, the best dodging midfielder in the league, but who's actually going to control the tempo of the offense?
I mean, Xavier Arline, I think, is going to.
Injuries permitting.
No, well, I mean, like, it. Yeah, it's a little bit about the lacrosse season injuries, but it's also just a little bit about, like, the football season injuries, too. Like,
so with him, he's interesting because he is going to be basically preparing to be the starting quarterback for Navy football next year. So
which gives me a significant pause.
Yeah, so he's doing basically double duty in 2023 spring. He is going to... Control the tempo is not what he's going to do.
You know, in my opinion, he's a change of pace back. He's the guy who you bring out of the box, he inverts on a shorty, and he's going to score like 40% of the time.
Right, and I think to some extent this is going to be a team that is controlled by its midfield. You know, whether it's Swanson and Skalniak are going to kind of control the way that they play. And I think that, you know, Amplo and Phipps have some interesting stuff in terms of like how early they're going to attack in the possession, depending on, you know, how far they get out and stuff like that. You know, they're going to be able to attack early, but then also, if they can't attack early, milk a possession. And I think that's where you're going to get a guy like Mac Haley, who's, I know he's a freshman, but I think he's going to be the guy that's going to maybe be as weird as...
There's a reason to believe that Haley's can contribute as freshman, for sure. So yeah, I'm not going to push back on that idea.
Yeah, but I think it's gonna. It's weird to think of a freshman as kind of the calming presence of an offense, but I think that's what he's going to actually kind of provide. But I think it's going to be like midfield early, and then if that doesn't work, Haley's going to, you know, calm things down, and then you're going to have our line to go in for the kill. Does it make sense?
It does make sense. It's just not the offensive structure that I would bet on based on the 12 years of college lacrosse.
Well,
we'll see. We shall see.
They got Jackson Bonnets, who I think is you know, just awesome. And
you know, yeah, they're going to create tons of chaos and wreck guys in their own defensive zone. There's no question about that.
And, you know, that first, you know, Navy, I mean, now we're getting really into the side conversation. But, you know, when you talk about, like, top units in the country, Navy's got one of the top midfield units in the country. I can't stress enough how much I think that midfield is really awesome. You know, them, Georgetown, who else would we put in that category of top midfield units? Princeton, yeah, definitely is one.
It depends on what you're valuing, right? But, like, you know, if it's offensive initiation, it's, yeah, I mean, I think Cornell with Kelleher and Blake get in there. But if it's versatility, I mean, Harvard's got 9 Swiss Army Knives who are all sophomores. They got to prove it, but, and Virginia, I mean, who knows? They, you know, have a bunch of attackmen who play midfield, but they're really good.
And let's not forget Penn. I mean, Sam Hanley, Gabe Fury, and James Shipley ain't too shabby.
Correct.
That's right.
Well said.
Well, the polls are fun, but, you know, they're polls. We play the games, right? You know, that's what's the soundbite? Like, you're here to play the games.
That's why you play the game.
Why they play the
game. Herm Edwards. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm pumped for some actual lacrosse. Like we said, there's some scrimmages this past weekend. We mentioned Rutgers and BU. Coming up this coming weekend, Maryland and Georgetown are scrimmaging, which is going to be, you know, pretty top-tier stuff. And then the aforementioned Navy-Virginia, that's another big one to watch. I was a little bit impressed seeing kind of the scoreline of Penn State. You know, they were scrimmaging, and Trainer had, you know, I think he had 4 or 5 goals in their scrimmage. And Jacksonville and Lynchburg played. You know, I think the big news that's coming out of that is Max Waldbaum. It looks like there's some sort of lower body injury, but how severe that is, if he's going to miss any time, is yet to be known. So that's something to kind of really keep an eye on if you're
also Lynchburg fan. Won.
And Lynchburg did win. You know, it sounds like, which is interesting because, you know, in our coming D3 rankings, we were deciding whether or not Lynchburg was a top 10 team. In D3.
Yeah.
So
I asked our D3 resident expert, Dan Kaplan, about it, and he was like, don't look too much into it. So 17-15 win.
Well, I think that
one Twitter user.
Yeah. By the same token, if you're handicapping men's 2023 World Championship results, I'm not sure that putting too much stock in the Haudenosaunee's win over Albany in 6 quarters is also doing you very much good. I mean, there are like 4 Albany players who I don't even know which team they play for because they're in contention for Haudenosaunee selection. So,
well, and Scott coached the Haudenosaunee.
Yeah. Their coach is among the people who might have been trading sidelines.
So, yeah, from what I gather from that scrimmage is that, you know, I think one of the hallmarks you're going to see of UAlbany this year is it kind of has, it's just a lot more unselfish than teams you've seen in this past few years, and kind of back to a little more of their heyday, where even though they had star players, they were generally like a pretty unselfish team. I think there's a lot of excitement coming out of Albany, and they were pretty happy with what happened in that game against the Haudenosaunee. But like you said, they were switching players. The goalie,
Jack Van Valkenburg.
Jack Van Valkenburg, who, you know, was pretty good in the World Games, you know, played for the Haudenosaunee for at least part of the game.
I think he qualifies as very good. He was very good.
But I don't think he's going to start for Albany. But so yeah, there was a lot of shared DNA between the Haudenosaunee and the Albany program. So I think if you're an Albany fan, though, just from what I heard, you should be pretty happy about that. What happened there? So preseason poll, we got 16 more of these to do, and then we're done. So Kevin and Terry, thanks for taking some time to share your votes. We'll talk about All Americans and some other stuff soon. And like I said, play some games.
Go get him. Thanks, guys.
College Lacrosse hype video on YouTube. Go watch it.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.